Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello there. You're very welcome along to this week's episode of the Group Chat Podcast. I'm Zara King. I'm joined in studio by Gav.
Hi.
And Richard.
Hiya.
Quite formal intro there, really, wasn't it? Given the fact that we decided to skip it.
You gave yourself a surname.
Did I?
Suddenly made yourself very formal there.
How fantastic.
And retracted ours, yeah.
I'm so sorry, Richard Chambers. I do apologise for that. Yeah. How are you?
Good, yeah. Any crack?
Not really. Good week.
It's grand.
It's been a grand week, yeah.
Not much going on.
I've been doing a lot of waiting around at the Stardust. We'll get to that in a little while.
It's been a tricky week from the perspective of being outside venues waiting to do live hits and not knowing how to dress.
Yes,
because the weather can
awful.
Change so much in the 15 minutes that you're standing around.
Yeah. Well, the only thing that's guaranteed is it's going to be rainy and windy at some point, so you may as well just dress for that.
And then be sweating buckets when you're standing outside
for the
20 minutes of glorious sunshine you might occasionally
wear. You need an in-the-middle jacket, and not too big jacket. Mm. But something which you'll give it a bit of windproofing as well.
It's not very April though, the wardrobe.
I did do a thing with Stephen Donnelly the other day in an interview, and at the start we had to like move him around a bit because the sun was actually blinding him, and by the end of the interview it was like bucketing rain. So I mean, such is the situation we're in. Anyway, great banter, folks. Yeah. Let's just jump right in to the Middle East, because I always feel like with this podcast, and what I like about this podcast is that I do feel like people who may not catch the evening news every evening do get a chance to sort of catch up and find out what's going on in the world. So Richard, I'm going to come to you first. Why are people hearing about Iran now when it comes to the conflict between Israel and Gaza?
Well, you might remember that at the outset of the Israeli actions in Gaza, sparked by October the 7th, they pointed to Iran and its role in funding Hamas as basically the chief bankroller of Hamas in many ways. But also they fund Hezbollah, which you'll probably have heard at some point over the last number of months, has continued to fire rockets into Israel. And Israel has launched numerous strikes into southern Lebanon, targeting Hezbollah, but also in some instances has led to the killings of journalists as well. So what happened in recent weeks is that Israel, although Israel has not formally claimed responsibility for this, launched a strike targeting members of what's known as the Revolutionary Guard, which is basically the Iranian military elite. This was in Syria, though, in Damascus, basically at the Iranian consulate there. So it's a consular building. It was targeted by Israel. Israel sort of kind of denied, really, or didn't really deny responsibility. Everyone accepts that it was Israel.
They allowed responsibility to be attributed to them without saying anything about it.
With ambiguity, which is actually the policy of Israeli action in terms of targeting other countries and in terms of their own nuclear weapons program. We might get to that later on when we talk about the demise of the world as we know it.
Yeah. Look forward to that later in the podcast.
So this happened. Iran vowed to hit back, and then over the weekend, it did hit back. It launched hundreds of drones, ballistic missiles from Iran towards Israel. Now, 99% of these, we understand, were shot down by what's known as the Iron Dome, which is the Israeli surface-to-air missile dome and network of missiles, and which is all mostly contributed or bought from the United States, as well as by the American Air Force, and the British RAF was also involved in shooting down drones, which might be interesting as well. Mm. But this was obviously seen as a huge escalation in terms of the regional war, which we talked about potentially brewing as a result of what's been happening in Gaza and in Israel since October the 7th. And never have we been closer to seeing it properly escalate out into a bigger war, lumping in more and more countries, because now everyone's waiting to see what Israel will do as a result of the tit for tat, which is now developed between Israel and Iran.
And I think the time of recording, just to say that the war cabinet in Israel has ended its fifth meeting to discuss the response to the attack. I mean, Gavin, like when we talk about the Iron Dome, for example, and the fact that, you know, the vast majority of these, you know, rockets or whatever didn't land, like, do you perceive that to be a success from Iran's perspective, or just, you know, a mark of like, we won't be messed with.
I think, yeah, the point of it was not so much to cause damage as to have a bit of a flex, really, a kind of an international show of strength, because that they mean business. Because ordinarily, there is always a bit of a deterrent because either side in these conflicts have so many other proxies or allies or bankrollers that any real escalation will possibly result in this spiral of tit for tat, and then all the parent bankrolling nations or bodies will get involved, and suddenly you have the whole thing spiraling into a global conflict. The point of this, really, from Iran's perspective, was to show that they could potentially try to do something like this without at least getting an immediate response. Like you mentioned, Israel having had 5 meetings now with no apparent decision at this point as to what they will do by way of retaliation. They are promising some kind of retaliation, but they're not saying what it is or even when it will be. They might keep it in their pockets and decide to have their retaliation at some point weeks or months or even years down the line. Who knows? I think the point from Iran's perspective was to show that they could prospectively do this without it immediately kicking off.
Yeah, and it's historic in the sense this is the first time Iran has directly targeted Israel, as in Israeli soil. So there is a huge significance to that. Now, Iran, in trying to sort of say, right, that's it, let's draw a line under this before this goes into, you know, something which could potentially go nuclear, which is obviously the ultimate fear of all of this sort of stuff, said that they considered the matter closed and there would be no further need for strikes.
Well, the Iranian president actually said that even the slightest attack by Israel on Iran will be, quote, dealt with fiercely and severely.
So, yeah, so Iran, after what happened over the weekend, said, right, that's us done. But now, obviously, the await, and David Cameron is, you know, the UK foreign minister, foreign secretary, I should say, who's in Israel today, trying to say, OK, let's cool the jets here. Let's calm this down. He says it's clear Israel has decided to respond once again to Iran, which is why the Iranian president is saying, like, look, you hit us again, we'll come back at you once more.
And I think the crucial point there is that everyone wants fighting to end, but everyone kind of wants to throw the last punch before the referee stands in and says, all right, lads, you've had enough. So everyone will always say, OK, that's it now. We've had our retaliation now. We can all stop fighting. But as long as you're the last person that was able to show some sort of aggression, Israel isn't going to stand around forever and say, OK, right, that's this skirmish over. Iran threw the last punch and now we're going to stand back and do nothing. And it never quite works out that way.
Meanwhile, then, the humanitarian crisis continues in Gaza, and you've got 1.7 million people almost who are starving, who are struggling, who are displaced. You know, so, I mean, in some ways, has this been a bit of a distraction from the reality of what's happening in Gaza, Richard?
Yeah, I think in an international sense, it certainly has. It has taken the focus off Gaza because strikes have continued by the IDF in Gaza. UNICEF says one child is now being killed or injured in Gaza every 10 minutes, while more than 40% of UN aid is now not being permitted to enter Gaza by Israel. And we're now approaching, I think it's 35,000 people almost killed in Gaza since October the 7th now. So if you're looking at this situation, both in Gaza and in terms of Iran and Israel, Gav, you mentioned that everyone wants to see this pull back from the brink. Well, if you're looking at it, as many observers are, there's one person who probably benefits from this, you know, blustering out and becoming a bigger thing and drawing in the United States, the UK, for example. The one person who's benefiting from that is probably Benjamin Netanyahu, who has been under huge pressure domestically. We've seen tens of thousands of people protest, calling for him to go. He's saying we're at war. This is important, and the survival of our state, i.e. Israel, is at stake. So being drawn into a confrontation, which is existential in terms of a threat, i.e. potentially, you know, Iran firing all of its military might at Israel, is something which could marshal support both in terms of Israel, in terms of the Israeli public and the population there, but in terms of the West as well. Because we have seen tensions to whatever end, not a huge amount of change in terms of policy from the West towards Israel in terms of support. But if you're ending up, this sort of thing could bring Israel, the US and the West closer
just
together.
Just before you come in, your other questions are, because at the time that this is going to air, or that people might get to hear this on a Thursday morning, there'll be a European summit ongoing in Brussels, Simon Harris's first official Brussels summit since taking over. There is definitely a sense at a European level that Benjamin Netanyahu was becoming increasingly a black sheep. You know, irrespective of whether you qualified support for Palestine or Gaza or statehood or anything like that, that Netanyahu had kind of irrevocably dirtied his bib at European level. But suddenly now the idea of trying to avert a possible all-out war, which would be nuclear, between Iran and Israel stroke the US, is that suddenly now this means that there has to be a certain level of, well, we might not like Netanyahu, but his country is also entitled not to be dragged into a nuclear catastrophe. So it's always going to be qualified now.
I think it's interesting just to go back to the point you made, Richard, about the internal views of Israelis, the people living in Israel, because I think there's definitely, it's been clear all along that there's been support there in terms of the war in Gaza, in a sense that they want their hostages home. People still feel very hurt and aggrieved by what happened on October 7th. But is certainly from the coverage that I've looked at, there's less enthusiasm to be getting into another row with Iran on the part of people living in Israel right now.
Yeah, it's interesting to watch this, because there obviously there's a huge, you know, spectrum of different views in Israel about these things. But politically speaking, it's been interesting to see some of the people who are speaking on behalf of, you know, the hostages' families, for example, saying that they believe that this is something which we need to back down from, that the focus of the Netanyahu government shouldn't be seeking a war in a regional sense with Iran. It should be getting the hostages back, which almost seems to continuously be forgotten about in terms of Israel pursuing, you know, its strikes in Gaza. There's been very little success in terms of returning hostages at this point in time, from an international perspective, and just from any basic analysis of the Israeli, you know, operation in Gaza. It's returned very few hostages. Mm. And the idea that you continue to keep on striking away, sending tanks towards Rafah, et cetera, is the way to get hostages home. It hasn't really done that. And all the while, the talks are grinding on in Qatar. Mm. Even Qatar, which has at various stages and repeatedly all the way through, it said, we're getting close. Something's going to happen here. We're going to get a deal over the line. We're feeling hopeful about it. Even it's now saying, yeah, things are drying up here. This isn't going anywhere fast. So it probably does serve Israel a great deal of good stead in the international sense, at least amongst its backers, that there is now a focus on something other than the deaths of civilians in Gaza.
Just before we move on, Gavin, I know you touched on Simon Harris there. I know I saw Simon Harris was speaking to CNN. He was on Christian Amanpour the other night. Like, is that because Simon Harris is a new world leader? Do you think Simon Harris is someone who's now being listened to when it comes to things like the Middle East?
I'd imagine that the large reason for having him on CNN was because he was a newer leader, and not necessarily because he's now going to be some kind of oracle about how to find his
so
way out of this.
So it's not because he sort of had indicated that maybe Ireland would recognise.
It was probably a subplot, or certainly a reason why you'd want to. But I suspect that Amanpour would be happy to speak to any newly crowned novelty, youngest ever prime minister. So there would be that sense.
So it's less clout sort of.
I think so. With all due respect to the holder of the office, I don't think that was necessarily the reason he was brought on. Just before we do move on though, Richard, you mentioned the Israel nuclear programme, such as there might be one, because there's always been a certain level of ambiguity.
Wink and nudge about it, which is such a weird thing to do about nuclear weapons.
But isn't that the point of why all of this has been so meaningful for the last week, is because if Israel is nuclear, and we know Iran is nuclear, and we know that Israel's biggest supporter, the US, is nuclear, if a proper war kicks off, that's the danger, isn't it? That nuclear warheads start going from A to B, and it all gets very grim very quickly.
Yeah, the ambiguity around the nuclear capabilities of both these countries is actually very strange. So Israel has always been ambiguous. It's never denied that it had one. But it doesn't really say, well, we have X amount of weapons, all that sort of stuff. It's very much regarded as the consensus view Israel has one. Now, Iran is a much more different thing, because remember there was that whole thing years ago, that agreement which was brokered by Barack Obama to try and stop Iran's nuclear ambitions. And then Iran was then saying, well, we're trying to just do it for nuclear energy, all that sort of stuff. Trump ripped up that deal. Israel has accused Iran of having a bomb, but nobody is 100% sure. I'm sure if you ask the intelligence agencies of, you know, the West, I'm sure they probably have a strong view on it. But the fact is, a confrontation between nuclear powers is something that is almost unthinkable. I think some international observers have viewed this situation as perhaps like the worst that we've seen in terms of the potential to just spiral out into an all-out World War III scenario that we've seen since the 1960s. And that is not a good situation for any of us to be in.
Now, we were talking last week, and we said we'd come back to it, about the situation in terms of, particularly in agriculture, farmers dealing with heavy rainfall. And Richard, you've been speaking to one online farmer.
Very famous online farmer.
Well, we love TikTok Taoiseachs and TikTok farmers. Isn't it?
to give Shane O'Sullivan, better known, I suppose, more broadly known maybe as the Kerry Cowboy, his credit. He has a broad footprint across the media at this point in time. Never mind just TikTok, never mind just Instagram, but TG Cahir as well, for example. But he is also, of course, as his name suggests, he is a farmer in County Kerry. And he has been great for years now, actually, at sharing the real life experiences of dairy farming in County Kerry. And because of what we've seen in terms of the weather over recent months, the extension of winter, it's had a huge impact on farmers. We talked about the potatoes in the east last week, at this time for dairy farmers. So Shane explained effectively what it means for farmers and why it's so important.
Hello, Group Chat Podcast. Shane O'Sullivan here. And we're talking about the bad weather and how it's affecting farmers. Where do we start? Here in Kerry, it began raining in the middle of September. We still had cows out at that stage, but we were giving them bales to supplement the grass. By October, they went into sheds for the winter, which was quite early. But usually when you have an early starting winter, it kind of balances out and you get a good spring, an early spring. That hasn't been the case at all this year. It has dragged on and dragged on with this constant rain. Now, there is grass in the fields. There's plenty of grass there for cows. The problem is the soil is so wet that cows can't go out into the fields. If they were to, they're too heavy. They'd plow up the ground. They'd destroy the field and it wouldn't grow the grass back. Now, this is a problem for several reasons. First and foremost, the animals' welfare. In Ireland, we're well known for having grass-fed cows that spend most of the year out in fields. But that obviously isn't happening with the ground being so wet. And cows are sick of being in sheds. Another problem is economically for farmers, it's a massive struggle. Nearly every farmer I know has ran out of the forage store they had and is after buying in more fodder to feed the cows, just to keep them fed. This is costing us at home almost 3,000 euro a week, which is a massive expense that we usually wouldn't have at this time of year. So a lot of farms wouldn't have money set aside. They wouldn't have been prepared for this. So we've got a problem for the farmers. We've got a problem for the animals. It's an unprecedented event and it's unclear where we're going from here. But please God, there'll be good weather on the way. The fields will harden and we'll have animals out in grass.
Gavin, the takeaway from that is it's costing them €3,000 a week to feed that the cattle. And also cows are sick of being in sheds, as he said himself.
And then they're glad that the cows have somebody to speak up for them on that front. But I literally gasped.
It's
like €3,000 a week. Like, I mean, when you just consider the expense of that, and that's like, it's enormous. You like €3,000 a week, and they've basically, when they ran out of bales by October, so they've basically been living off extra fodder for 6 months now. So that's like 25 weeks times €3,000 a week, €75,000 of money you don't already have. Livestock doesn't sell for a huge amount, considering the amount of man hours and labor and feed that goes into them. Yeah. So like, when you just consider the financial drain that there is, like it makes it all the more understandable why, whenever you do have unpredictable weather patterns, that you hear farmers immediately saying that they need some kind of state aid. I imagine, though, the problem now is probably actually finding sufficient fodder, given that they'll have basically been living off that for almost 6 months now.
True enough. Actually, a farmer I know from the southwest was actually on to me as well during the week after what we said last week. Mm. And he said his cows would normally be out basically a month ago. So basically mid-March and now we're in mid-April.
After St. Patrick's Day, isn't it?
Yeah. So it was around an extra month in. Plus, as you say, the start of winter was earlier. I saw the Journal was covering this as well earlier in the week. And actually one commenter there put it really well. Says the doom of all of this sits on your shoulders day in, day out, while you look at long-term forecasts and see no end to this wet weather. So the psychological impact of this, the mental health impact of this is really, really tough as well. And it's probably the understated element of this when you have no certainty, no clarity about the direction things are going, and you know how long your animals have already been inside for and how long they should normally have been out by this point. There is an impact on that.
And it's something that we've talked about before, just in relation to farming as a profession or as a career choice, that you're by yourself a lot of the time as well. So you carry a lot of these worries when you're on your own on the land and you're trying to get the work done day to day. So it's interesting to hear someone like Shane, particularly that young voice in agriculture, you know, that he's there to kind of discuss and have an open dialogue, but also, you know, engage back and forth with people on this particular issue. Is there much support there for them now, Gavin? Is government recognising the challenges?
There seemed to be an immediate change of tack, actually, funnily enough, just after Simon Harris were elected, that there seemed to be a level of reluctance on the government's part, but simply because of how open-ended the commitment would be this time around, that when you're already months into a crisis and you don't know how much further it might go, there was a little bit of a reluctance to basically start writing a blank cheque to support an industry that was under pressure. And since the appointment of Simon Harris, there appears to be this renewed acknowledgement that actually you can't let these people stand by themselves. They just don't know, have the resources to be able to sink €3,000 in Shane's case or more in the case of bigger farmers. They just don't have that capability. So there has been some renewed push at getting to look at it. But again, actually supply is an issue because of how much of it has been used in the last 6 months. Funnily enough, it crosses my mind in the middle of all this. I don't know whether you might remember it, Richard, because you were in college the same time as me. Our midterm break in March in UCD always used to be 3 weeks. And it was always the latter 3 weeks of March because it was lambing season.
That was always
the break. And that was the break, was around St. Patrick's and running up to the end of March, because consistently that was always the time of year when the veterinary students and the ag students would need to be outside of classrooms because it was lambing season. Now you'd routinely see lambs being born in like December or January, which, and that's only in the 15 or 20 years since we were around, when there was a more stable calendar to these things. All the natural rhythms of nature all just completely going out the window. And I don't really know how all this ends.
I used to say that all the time, like the trees wouldn't know whether they were coming or going, particularly in the autumn, you know, like the leaves weren't falling off. You know, like you'd be sitting there and there'd still be like trees in kind of full bloom and you'd be sort of going, they don't know whether they're coming or going. I want to move on to the situation in the FAI, because which one, you might say, because there's a couple of situations in the FAI.
I'd like to rule myself out of becoming Ireland manager at this point. So I feel like it's necessary.
We start the manager thing, because I believe, when I don't profess to be a professional here, but they're going to miss this deadline apparently to appoint a new manager.
Yeah, I think you have to start though at the real, you do have to start, I think, at the top of the situation.
Right, you know,
the CEO, so Jonathan Hill, who was, when he was appointed as the permanent chief executive of the Football Association of Ireland back in 2020, obviously he came after the John Delaney era. He was the first permanent man into the job since John Delaney departed that role. The FAI president, Gerry McEnany, fairly famously said that the appointment of Jonathan Hill would mark a turning point for Irish football after the events of the previous 18 months. If it was a turning point, it's turned into a circle because we have had... if you just look at the goals of it, and Jonathan Hill did some good things, and that's to his credit, but if the overall goals of Jonathan Hill were to restore trust in the FAI, he failed to do that. Another Oireachtas committee effectively sealed his death warrant in terms of his position as the CEO of the Football Association. The throwaway joke about the payment made to him in lieu of untaken holidays, breaching the government's bailout cap on salaries there, that he couldn't be paid more than the Secretary General of a department. Effectively, funding from Sport Ireland was temporarily suspended for the FAI as a result of all of this. So fail that one. In terms of attracting a sponsor to the men's national team, that's only been sorted recently. Sky, who have very gamefully supported the women's national team for quite some time now, effectively just thrown in their oar with the men's national team. So it's effectively a 2-for-1 deal. In terms of, you know, restoring the feeling...
Does that have an energy of like just settling for the sponsor they could get in the end?
It doesn't feel great. Like, it's great that Sky have done this and have taken on the sponsorship because they needed a men's national team sponsor. But it took a long time for them to get that in. And then when you look at the team's fortunes on the pitch as well, not particularly great. You mentioned the long-standing quest to appoint a successor to Stephen Kenny as the men's national team manager. This is an unmitigated disaster. We have had multiple delays. We have had multiple names leaked to the press. And for all of them to say, I'm not doing that job, it's a massive embarrassment.
Again, I'm asking you this for those of us who don't have a clue really what's going on. Does John O'Shea want the job full time, or has he said?
I think he does.
He seems open to it.
Oh, does he?
Yeah.
Okay.
But that
he'd be good at it. How long has he been doing it? A couple of weeks?
He was only the interim manager for two friendlies that were broadcast on Virgin Media last month against Belgium and Switzerland. One was a 0-0 draw, and the other one was a 1-0 loss. But considering they're two teams that have much better strength in depth than we do, they weren't awful results, and the team played. Okay. Not brilliantly, but played adequately. John O'Shea seems open to taking the job as manager, but was asked about it only this week and said, listen, I can't tell you. I genuinely don't know. I haven't been offered it. I haven't been told. I'm not in the running. I don't know what's going on. But remember that last month when he was announced as being the interim coach, there was an announcement that we were going to have a permanent coach unveiled at some point in April. And now we're halfway through April, there is no news of a permanent coach. And because the CEO has now been disposed of, it is unlikely that we're going to be able to, in the short term, have a full-time appointment. Which, when you consider the run-in that there's been to this, is extraordinary. Like, Stephen Kenny was basically told, or he basically knew his goose was cooked last summer, last June. Results in qualifiers for the Euros don't go his way. So we know in June that he's basically going to be told his time is up. In October, he has his last games, and he's actually dismissed. We are now 6 months on from his official dismissal, and de facto close to a year from him knowing that his time was going to be up. We don't even have a CEO who's responsible for leading the charge.
Okay,
now.
So can I ask you, right, and like this might seem like an overly simplistic question, but like, what is it about the FAI that is so problematic? Like, why is it that they can't just get their house in order? Like, what's the problem? Is it that, you know, like, I just don't understand how you can have so much transition and so much change and still not make any progress.
Look, I think to be fair to the FAI, there has been some good things which have happened in recent years. Obviously, the women's team.
Absolutely. The women's team is the good thing that's happened.
Well, there's also the progress in the League of Ireland and selling out stadiums week after week.
It's been under their watch.
And well,
not necessarily
like
under their action.
A lot of people associated with League of Ireland and women's league, the basically domestic league in terms of women as well, would say that it's more the grassroots workers who do that. But you can fall into the trap of saying everything that's going wrong with the FAI is the chief executive's fault and everything
and
good with
the
FAI is nothing
people.
To do with it. I think that's a mistake. So you have to give credit to where it's due.
And works together.
It's very difficult. Like, there's been long-standing problems in terms of football administration in this country in terms of the top level at the FAI. It predates John Delaney as well. But
even when football administration internationally has had its own problems as well.
It has, and yeah, I think the changing of personnel as well is always a big problem. Like, so much of Jonathan Hill's the recent end of his tenure, when he obviously was appointed in the pandemic, a lot of the problems. Some people will point to the fact that he never moved over here was a problem in terms of it sent the wrong message in terms of does he really have the commitment to overhaul football in Ireland after everything it's been through for years and years and years.
For people who aren't aware, by the way, he was London based, so he was coming over to work in Dublin 3 or maybe 4 days a week maximum, but still doing 1 day a week from London and never fully relocated, which was seen as a bit of a psychological issue.
Yeah, and then there's also the amount of key roles now which have been left either unfilled or filled on an interim or temporary basis. I think it was Mary Hannigan in the Irish Times during the week said the FAI should stand for find an interim, because that's how effectively the organisation is being run at some level at this point in time. It's not good. As somebody who cares deeply about Irish football at all levels of it, it's annoying, and it's, you know, disheartening to see that there's still, despite all of the promises of change and the fact that we've clearly everyone's learned the lessons, or at least should have learned the lessons by now, about how to run the organisation or how not to run the organisation. It's depressing, really, that it's just consistently dragged through, you know, quagmire after quagmire.
But can I ask you, because obviously you go to the games and you enjoy the League of Ireland games and you're at the match, what is the talk at the matches? Do you think that people are bothered by what's happening at the top, or are they just really enjoying the game in their local, at their local level?
Yeah, well, like, I mean, you often hear chants against the FAI. Like, chants against the FAI are
chants against the FAI at games.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
That's not great, Gav, is it?
It's not ideal, but I wonder, though, do you have the joy when you're in the stands in the Jody watching Bows on a Friday night? Are you're relishing the fact that something is going well, that the league is in such a good place, that it almost seems that you can almost park your concerns about the FAI? Because
no, you can't. You can't because I think
but it has a trickle down effect, surely, or like it obviously has an impact.
It does, yeah. Everybody has concerns about the support given to the league, and even while things as they are now in a really strong era in terms of growth, there's still fundamental problems in terms of funding for stadium building, stadium repair, all that sort of stuff. The fundamentals haven't been right in the League of Ireland in a long, long time, going back decades. So that's something that needs to be addressed. So it's really concerning, and it is really just, you know. It's hard to see it digging. It's like the results on the pitch changing without the structures around everything going in the right direction. They have not gone in the right direction for a long time, sadly.
Okay. So I can bring you an update in relation to the Stardust for anyone who's been following it over the last couple of months now at this stage. There has been a verdict reached, but it hasn't been read out in court yet. It will be read out tomorrow afternoon, Thursday afternoon at 2 o'clock. And the reason for the delay of this is because, and we've always known this all along, is that the coroner wants to give families plenty of notice and plenty of time so they can be there on the day. So as you can imagine, you know, people are working full-time jobs. Some of the families have been in there. Some have been there every day, those who are retired and who are able to be there every day. But others will have wanted a bit of notice to get there. So the coroner giving those families a prior notice that the verdict will be read out in court at 2 o'clock tomorrow. Something that we do know is that it's a majority verdict, whatever verdict it is, it's been reached by majority. And that we will have that read out tomorrow at 2 o'clock. So by the time you listen to this podcast, you may in fact know the verdict, but we'll bring it to you on the news at 5:30 on Thursday.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
So, Gav, how is Simon Harris getting on after his first full week of being the Taoiseach?
I love a nice open-ended question with a simple answer, which is, can't really say, because he's only been in a week and he hasn't really been able to do much. I think it's been fascinating for the first two batches of leaders' questions that he's taken, how much the questioning has oriented on some modern, but a lot of former health matters, trying to point out that Simon Harris's own record in the offices that he has held has been a little checkered or blemished in some circumstances. I think actually what's more striking is that he has spent so much of his time being kind of outward looking and not necessarily focusing on domestic bread and butter. So when last week we were talking about his trip to Brussels to meet the heads of the European institutions, he has had a mini summit in Warsaw last Thursday. Last Friday, he had the Spanish Prime Minister over for a meeting again when they were talking about international affairs, primarily about recognition of Palestinian statehood and the likes. There is definitely an argument that Simon Harris has spent perhaps too much of his honeymoon period, such as there is one when you weren't elected into the job, he was just appointed by Fine Gael reshuffling, on international issues and not actually very much time or enough time on domestic stuff. So we spoke last Wednesday when we were recording last week's episode about the fact that he was missing leaders' questions. Unbeknownst to us at the time, there was actually a big hoo-ha kicking off in the Dáil about the fact that Simon Harris wasn't attending for leaders' questions on the day. Given that Simon Harris couldn't do that because he was getting briefed on other things, he was meeting with other coalition leaders, he was making phone calls to the Prime Minister of the UK, to Volodymyr Zelensky, to the First and Deputy First Ministers, and a certain amount of that is the job because Ireland is a small peripheral island on the cusp of Europe and we need to have focus on international relations. That's part of the job. But when Simon Harris knew that he was going to be in Brussels this week for the European Council meeting that's happening on Wednesday night and Thursday, you'd question the wisdom of him spending a lot of last Wednesday not in the Dáil, standing up and announcing what he was going to do and taking questions and opening himself to scrutiny, but getting briefed on meetings with the European presidents that he had last Thursday. Like, what I'm getting at really is that, did he have to take those meetings last Thursday when he was going to be in Brussels this week anyway? And I think that there is a genuine question that when he has so little time in the Dáil to move the needle and really drive his own agenda, he shouldn't have been losing a week of that focusing on international affairs when really his whole thing is bread and butter at home, progress at home, moving mountains to fix housing at home. If you're going to do all that stuff at home and your whole identity is making differences at home, I don't think he should have been spending his first couple of days looking outwardly and taking a trip to Brussels to meet people that he was going to see this week anyway.
The counterpoint to that is, I mean, should he have said to Pedro Sanchez, don't come over, I have to focus on domestic matters, or should he have rejected invitations? Like, could he have done that? I don't think
I don't know the full protocol about how these things come about, but when the two of them were at the same event in Warsaw on Thursday anyway, and the bilateral meeting that they had on Friday was effectively about half an hour, and they were discussing how they were on the same page of a lot of things, you'd wonder whether they needed to have the separate standalone event. In much the same way as last week we were talking about how the cabinet meeting that happened on Tuesday night, in the ceremonial one in Orson Uachtaráin, could have been expanded to become a slightly more substantive one and freed up Wednesday to do other things. You'd query the scheduling and the sort of the choreography of all of this. There is, funnily enough, and I don't know whether this was his own initiative or whether he was handed a diary, but they always say whenever a new minister is appointed that the way the civil servants get the measure of this minister and the way that they determine whether this minister is open to their own agenda or the agenda that they're coming into the office with. In other words, will they be the tail that wags the dog or vice versa? The acid test is they hand them a diary that's packed full of engagements. They say, okay, you're new into the job, so you need to meet with this official, you need to meet with this official, you need to get to know all of these people within the department, you need to meet these external stakeholders. And in the case of a Taoiseach, they probably say you need to meet the President of the European Commission, President of the Council, President of the Parliament, all these other Brussels-based figures. And the measure is, does the politician repudiate that diary and say, no, I appreciate what you're doing, but I've got other stuff that I need to get to the bottom of first? Or are they led by the civil servants in taking whatever diary is put in front of them? I haven't yet gotten an answer to that question, but I think it's a really curious thing to find out is whether it was his own decision to be so outward looking, or was he handed a diary and say, these are the meetings you have to take?
Was it about trying to sort of like you know, stake a claim on an international stage, so that there was sort of an element of like, I have arrived. Hi, I'm Simon, and I'm the guy from Ireland now, and I'm yeah. running Ireland now.
There probably is a need for him to go and introduce himself as being something of an unknown quantity, because mm. one of the things that's unusual about the jobs,
he wouldn't have done a lot of travelling in his role before, really, would he?
This is the point I was about to make, that he's unusual in that the jobs that he's had for the last 8 years basically don't have a European dimension to them. In other words, when he was Minister for Health for 4 years, there is no European Council of Health Ministers, because health is not an EU competence. They sort of took on the bulk procurement stuff when it came to vaccines and coordinating PPE and stuff in 2020. But there is no coordination of services cross-border. So there's no monthly meeting of EU health ministers in Brussels that he would have been going to. And likewise, when it comes to further and higher education, there is no comparable body. So the only times he's ever really been in Brussels were when he was a junior minister back in finance in 2014 for the odd meeting of the Eurogroup. And then when he was filling in as justice minister, and he was going over there for a couple of monthly meetings when he was in his 6 month tenure filling in for Helen McEntee. Otherwise, he just is not well known. So there's definitely an argument that he needs to go over and introduce himself and sort of be prepared to make tracks and try and make an impression. But the meeting that he's going to this week only kicks off on Wednesday evening. So he could have done leaders' questions last Wednesday, first day in the Dáil, made a better first impression, and then maybe given it a miss today, because when he was going to be going to Brussels anyway, go a few hours earlier, meet all these stakeholders, and do it all in one go. Mm. I would question the way in which his diary has been constructed in the last 10 days.
He is very eager, though, isn't he, to keep his followers online up to date with his, yeah. you know, his sort of, you know, progress and things that he's been doing. And he did post sort of something akin to that last week.
Yeah, well, he's been doing kind of diary stuff on TikTok and Instagram. He literally wrote a diary for the Business Post last Sunday, which was like, here I am now, I'm in the job and here's what I did, which is helpful in some senses, that it does at least put a diary out there. It's like, I'm not just sitting around in the office, like on a spiral chair, swinging around. I'm actually like meeting people. I thought it was a little disappointing that he didn't give more insight into why he was doing these things, which is supposed to be the same concern that I've just outlined a few minutes ago, that he was saying, I had this meeting and it's important, and then I did this thing and that's important. There was no sense of scrutiny or like presentation as to why these things are priorities. It was just, I've been very busy, but not really getting under the skin as to why he's chosen to do some things ahead of others.
And I think people, like, you could argue people could be concerned about that being words instead of actions, you know, that actions speak louder than words, and that actually, you know, making a list of all the things you're doing is lovely and everything, but actually, if you're doing them, maybe it would be more obvious than you having to declare that you're doing them, perhaps, Richard.
Yeah, it's interesting to see the tactic of here, like even the daily updates now, he's posted at least on Instagram anyway. One thing, they have all this money for government communications and press officers. They can't get him a lapel mic for these videos, which he's doing to camera, talking about what he did for the day. Get him a microphone, for God's sake. Anyway, but one thing he said he's not doing is the patent court referendum thing. Mm. So this is going to be, I think, this is an interesting thing to keep an eye on for the next while, is what things is Simon Harris dropping by the wayside? Because again, he only has a limited amount of time to do things. Stuff is going to be sacrificed here. Abortion services reform, obviously that's been the spotlight this week. Again, there's a concern there that that's not going to be looked at in the lifetime of this government.
I think it's unlikely.
In the lifetime of this government, and not in the lifetime of this government, is a key phrase to keep an eye on for next while.
Because when you just do the sums, so we know Simon Harris says he wants the government to run full term, and that means having a general election called next February and probably held next March. Other things might get in the way of that, because we do have the European elections coming up in June. There's the Limerick mayoral election. There could be a few vacant seats in the Dáil as a result of those. There's an argument that instead of having by-elections in November, for 3 months ahead of a general election anyway, you might as well just dissolve the whole kit and caboodle and run before Christmas. So that's one argument. But even if the government runs the full term, after this week, there are 11 sitting weeks in Leinster House before summer recess, which isn't a huge amount to get new things over the line. After the recess, there are at most 12 weeks before Christmas. Now, after Christmas, nothing is going to happen, because at most there are 2 weeks of Dáil sittings after Christmas, so nothing. So like 23 weeks, and when you include, you know, stuff that wasn't originally on the agenda, like the EU Migration Pact, which is going to dominate Dáil business in a couple of weeks' time, somebody at some point will table a motion of no confidence in somebody. That then becomes a day of Dáil business that you don't get back. Little other things come up along the way. The budget is an entire week. Summer economic statement in June or July. Again, it's all Dáil time that's wrapped up. You actually have very little time in the Dáil to do the things that you want to do. Like even if he's talking about moving mountains on housing, one way to do that would be the overhaul of the planning system that's currently worming its way very slowly through the Housing Committee in Leinster House. when that comes out of the committee, it's going to have to go back to the Dáil. It's a bill with like 1,000 sessions. Like, it'll take a week or two just to get that through the Dáil alone by itself. Then it has to get through the Shannon. It takes so long to do stuff that if you're coming to the table with new stuff now, it's not going to be done, which is why it really is a question of what gets dropped and what that is currently weaseling through will actually be allowed to make its way before the finish line, before time runs out.
So the number of houses available to rent for people across the HAP, the Housing Assistance Payment Scheme, stood at 38 nationwide, according to the latest report from the Simon community. Like, in some ways, this is clearly a disgraceful situation, but also somewhat not shocking, Richard.
No, it's not. Well, this is what Housing Campaigners have been saying for
a long time.
Years now, is that HAP is not fit for purpose. It's only been a change of 5 additional properties added to, you know, being accessible to people who have HAP since December. So whoop-de-doo on that. Great success for another ultimately meaningless scheme in terms of the scope that it has. Obviously, people who are on that scheme benefit from it, but it is clearly not working in the way that it's intended. And the amount of properties which are in which prospective landlords say that they will not accept HAP, that remains a big problem as well. In 10 of the 16 areas, there were no HAP properties at all available to rent through the scheme in any household category. So those were Athlone, Cork City Centre, Galway City Suburbs, Galway City Centre, County Leitrim, Limerick City Suburbs, Limerick City Centre, Sligo Town, Portlaoise and Waterford City Centre. So again, it's completely unsurprising. But when you put it into the context as well of the property price inflation and how much that's gone up, that was only confirmed there today. 6.1% rise in average house prices in the 12 months to February, up from 5.4% previously. 6 months in a row now in which you've had headline inflation increasing in the residential property market. We talk about, well, what impact should Simon Harris be looking to have? He needs to do something fairly fast on housing across the board, because whether it's at the rental end of the spectrum in terms of HAP, or it is at the top line of it in terms of house prices and affordability and getting people into homes, it's not working out.
We do hear so much about the idea of increasing the HAP payment because people need physically more money to actually work with and more money to essentially bargain with, because the cost of rent is just outrageous. But then there's that argument of, like, you're just lining the pockets of landlords then if you give more money to those. But then what's the alternative? You leave people homeless and with nowhere to go.
This is it. And once you have a system like HAP, which was originally intended just to put more money in people's pockets to help them afford a roof over their heads, and then effectively becomes an indirect subsidy for the property owning classes, it's very difficult ever to unwind that, because it just becomes like a little bit of an arms race where property prices keep going up, rent keeps going up. So at some point, somebody has to bite the bullet and increase the HAP thresholds or the HAP payments so that more people can qualify for it and that they've got more money in their pockets. But as soon as they're in the market alongside other private tenants that don't have that assistance, it just becomes an arms race and property prices get ever higher, and it results in the state having to spend more and more doing it. I don't know what the answer is to unwind it, or how you'd possibly have a system in which people are able, of their own means, to afford somewhere of quality standard and not be squeezing other people out, other than mass supply. But I genuinely don't know how you suddenly make the market less reliant on bailouts, which are now running to the tune of literally billions from the state, when that's now just what's baked in.
Just as we're having this conversation, it just occurs to me that it's been a while since we've asked people for voice notes, and this actually might be a good opportunity just to put that out there, that if you are listening to the podcast now and you're thinking, like, this whole housing situation that we talk about this nearly every week on the podcast at this point, week in, week out, all of us will accept a voice note from you guys on probably Instagram is the best place to send a voice note, actually. So either Richard Chambers at News Chambers, at
Gav Riley,
or at ZaraKing.news. If you have thoughts, if you're passionate, if you're listening to this and you're thinking, I'm really frustrated, really annoyed about the housing situation, whether you're a renter, maybe you're trying to buy, send us your voice notes. And I want to come back to this next week using your voices, because I want to hear from people. Like, literally, I think sending a message is lovely and we love receiving the messages, but I actually think hearing the voices would be fantastic.
Yeah, reading out comments, it doesn't have the same impact as people with their own voice. Particularly in light of that, there was that National Youth Council of Ireland report during the week about, you know, the strain of housing and accommodation for young people. Nearly half of young people dissatisfied with their current housing situation. More than 1 in 5 have skipped meals due to financial constraints, and half of 18 to 29 year olds have low mental well-being. Of course, housing very much to the top of the agendas on all of these issues. So it will be great to hear from people in that regard. Yeah,
we'd love to hear it. Finally, before we go, have you watched Scoop on Netflix?
No.
Have you not watched it?
I'm not watching it.
You're like, you're refusing to watch it.
I thought you did watch it.
No, I didn't watch it, no. Surprise.
On the meeting of the day we're going to talk about.
Yeah, I was interested in the conversation, but I have not watched it.
Well, I've watched it.
I've seen Ripley, if you want to talk about that.
Twice.
Is Ripley good?
Brilliant.
We're talking about Scoop.
I have tried to watch Scoop. Scoop, by the way, for people who aren't familiar, is the Netflix dramatisation of the process by which BBC Newsnight got the Prince Andrew interview, the famous one about Pizza Express in Woking and how he can't sweat, all this stuff. Yeah. I have tried to watch it twice, and one would think this would be right up our alley because of the industry in which you and I and you work. Yes. I've fallen asleep watching it twice.
Is that just because you're tired and you small kids, though?
Well, that's, I have no doubt that's a contributing factor, but I've found that the pace of it really odd. But actually, I'm also less engaged by it. Because much as they're trying to be realistic, and now the Newsnight studio looks like Newsnight and everything else is quite faithful, and the Andrew lookalike is very, very good, I can't get over the fact that an actress as good as Gillian Anderson does such a weak Emily Maitlis. Because you and I have both issued to the listen to the audiobook of Airhead, Emily Maitlis's kind of sort of memoir about her time in Newsnight. Yeah. She doesn't at all sound like the Gillian Anderson rendition of herself. Gillian Anderson has basically copied and pasted her excellent Margaret Thatcher voice from that biopic and transplanted it into Emily Maitlis and made her behave in a way that anyone who has ever heard Emily Maitlis speak knows she does not speak it.
She's an excellent actress, but she doesn't do Emily Maitlis as Emily Maitlis. Like, Emily Maitlis is so... Like, she in Scoop, you know, she sort of portrays her as being really like sort of aloof and a kind of not a particularly like hands-on member of the Newsnight team. Mm. And like, you know, the dog is running around the office and stuff. And actually, I know that Chris Shipp, who's been on the podcast here before, talked on his Royal podcast. He reviewed it and he was talking about, you know, things like, you know, you can't just pull up to the front gates of Buckingham Palace and get left in the front
gate.
When
you're trying to be so faithful about like what the settings are and somebody stealing the QE2 branded teaspoon or whatever else it is. And then the idea that Sam McAllister, the producer who secures the interview, goes in for her meeting with Prince Andrew and walks in the front gate.
And he was also saying that he had been talking to some colleagues who were saying, look, people don't bring their dogs in around the BBC. Now, I don't know if she did or she didn't, but I just think some of it just made Emily Maitlis seem really like disconnected in a way that I just don't, doesn't resonate for me.
Were they trying to inject a bit of colour into it in a way that maybe they thought that this would be attractive to foreign audiences, you know, who might not have been as up on the story or not as engaged with it or whatever? What were they trying to do? Like, what do you think the objective was?
Yeah, possibly. Yeah, I would say possibly. I think there's probably an element of like dramatizing it up a little bit. But in the same breath, I think if you're going to do something and someone's going to portray somebody who is a living person,
currently working
in the public
person,
eye, who's going to be working as a journalist.
It's the point that they're in the public eye. That it's one thing to try and just take a little bit of dramatic license and to try and make it a little bit more compelling from that sense. But when it's so patently fictional, like it's a dramatic license that is easily disproven by anyone who's ever listened to the newsagent's podcast or remembers her working on Newsnight or has listened to her book or seen her in any number of the other media that she's ever done. She doesn't talk like that. She 100%. Doesn't behave like that. Like, so it's a bizarre license to take.
I agree. Like, none of us have actually met Emily Maitlis, but having, as you said, listened to the audiobook, followed her work very closely, I would personally, my takeaway is that this is not like Emily Maitlis at all. And I actually think if I was Emily Maitlis, I'd be a little bit...
Yeah.
I'd just be a little bit sort of miffed by the portrayal.
I feel
of
like it undermines the process of trying to portray this as a dramatic version of what actually happened when you've taken such ridiculous license.
Still to this day, and actually I don't know if I sent you guys a link to there was a YouTube interview that Emily Maitlis gave about doing that interview with Prince Andrew. And, you know, like, she is so excellent at the work that she does and so meticulous in her preparation for that. That's probably a better watch than Scoop, if I'm really honest.
There's another dramatization about this interview coming out. I don't know if anybody knows.
Emily Maitlis is involved in that, I think.
Yeah. I didn't realise that. Why do we need dramatizations about things that recently happened? Like two dueling ones. Michael Sheen playing Prince Andrew is probably very good.
Ooh,
Ruth Wilson is playing Emily Maitlis. But
where's that appearing, or when's that?
Amazon Prime. Yeah, so Emily Maitlis is an executive producer on this.
I saw that,
One of the things people have been talking about with regards to Scoop was the fact they put the whole interview in there. Did they need to dramatise the whole thing?
With the whole interview in, that probably was a bit unnecessary.
Billie Piper
is a great actress and she was very good in it. We're just out of time now, I'm sorry.
All right. I'm all for including the whole interview,
but
fine.
Final take before we go.
I look forward to the other version to see if it's better.
Okay. I won't be watching either anyway.
Well, thank you, Richard. We appreciate that. We appreciate you, my friend. Thank you for listening. Thanks to the team in gallery and on the studio.
Voice notes, please, to all of us. And if you really can't be bothered doing a voice note, the group chat at virginmedia.ie is how you can email.
Send us a voice note. Voice notes, we want to hear your voice. We'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.